bizarre, Richard insisted. It was tuberculosis. My husband's gaze flicked to his sister, Nancy, who hadn't found a husband yet and who wasn't likely to find one, looking as frail as she did now. Her skin was like paper, and she was unable to muster even a brittle smile. Indeed, the back of the settee appeared to be all that held her upright. I knew Tom was imagining what sort of mischief she'd gotten herself into here at Bazaar. Was she taking laudanum, too?
Nancy hasn't been feeling well,
Richard said, putting a comforting hand upon her knee. The gesture was so intimate that Tom went rigid, a shadow over his eyes. And in spite of my happily gurgling baby boy and Anne's giggles as she ran about the house, the air went thick with tension. So thick that I actually startled when someone banged on the front door. None of the house servants went to answer it, but Judy got up and peered out a window at an angle from which she couldn't be seen. Going pale, she said, "It's our neighbors." "Well, aren't you going to let them in?" I asked, anxious as any southern woman to the dictates of hospitality. Of course, if I'd known what the neighbors had come to say, I'd have barred the door myself. The Harrisons hadn't come on a social visit. Indeed, while her husband glowered, Mrs. Harrison left her bonnet on, though she tugged nervously at the pink ribbon holding it to her head. Standing just inside the room, as if she intended an abrupt exit, she finally said, "The rumor is still being passed around, Miss Nancy. We thought you ought to know."
"What rumor?" my husband asked.
Mr. Harrison continued to glower, but to answer Tom, Mrs. Harrison chirped nervously, "The slaves are saying that the night your sisters and your brother-in-law stayed as guests in our home, Richard was seen taking a bundle out to the woodpile and—" She glanced at Nancy's belly, fluttering a bit in her unease. Before she could continue her thought, Mr. Harrison cut her off with a blunt,
"They're saying Miss Nancy gave birth to Richard's bastard and that he chopped it to pieces."
Shooting to his feet, Richard cried,
"Slander!"
Richard's outrage was so convincing that I put a hand on Tom's arm to still him. But my husband, too, shot to his feet, and he was plainly not convinced. Richard insisted,
"That's a damnable lie."
"Is it?"
Mr. Harrison shot back.
"You drag your whoring to my house and stain my name."
"Please," his wife begged of him, as if she might swoon away at the unpleasantness. And when her husband quieted, she added, "Nevertheless, you should know it's being said. The servants claim they heard screams in the night and found bloody sheets in Miss Nancy's bed." Nancy's pretty big eyes rounded with fear or outrage, I couldn't say which. "They were groans, not screams. I was ailing from womanly troubles and pains in the abdomen. I've always suffered from colic. My sisters can tell you that's true. Isn't that right?" "Of course it's true," I said reflexively. "She's always had terrible colic." She'd never had colic in her life as far as I knew, but what else could I say as my husband went from red to purple? The moment the Harrisons uttered some stilted courtesy and took their leave, Tom whirled on Nancy, grabbing her by the arms and pulling her to shaky feet.
"Were you seduced, sister?"
Tears filled Nancy's eyes. "There was never any baby. Someone's telling lies." My husband didn't believe it. He shook her, that familiar angry vein pulsing in at his temple. I'd never seen him so angry before, but I understood the cause. Not just the fear that young Nancy had been exploited by the man to whom we'd entrusted her care, but also that if her honor had been sullied by a baby begot out of wedlock, It had sullied Tom's honor, too. And that was to say nothing of a dead baby. When Nancy looked to Richard for help, my husband's rage worsened, his knuckles going white. Tom turned to Richard, too, and I thought he might commit murder then and there. But just then, Judith gave a bitter laugh. "It's just slave talk. This is what happens when we hold Negroes in bondage. I imagine this dreadful rumor is being spread by Mr. Harrison's slaves to embarrass him, or to urge him to be a better, more benevolent father over them." Judith's explanation had merit. Mr. Harrison was known as a cold and heartless slave master. His slaves very well might want to call his honor and authority into question. I glanced at Tom, hoping he'd calm himself, but my husband's jaw was so tight I thought he'd chip a tooth if he tried to speak. He didn't speak. Not a word. Only later that night, on the pillow beside me, did he finally ask, "It's too preposterous a tale about Nancy to be believed, isn't it?" "Entirely preposterous." Silently, I counted back the months. Why, in order for it to be true, she'd have got with child when last we visited here. Besides, I couldn't imagine how any woman could hide a pregnancy. Sally hadn't been able to hide it. When I was fat with my own two babies, there wasn't a person alive I could have fooled. And even if Nancy could hide such a thing, I couldn't imagine anyone killing a baby. Certainly not my own kin. "Don't think on it another moment, Tom. We'll put it out of our heads," I said, stroking his arm. "That's precisely what I aim to do, especially since I was nursing the newborn and worrying for my daughter, whose tummy troubles brought her whimpering into our bed in the wee hours of the morning. Laying her against the warmth of her father's strong shoulder, I took a candle from the bedside and padded barefoot down the stairs to search out some peppermint for her to gnaw on. The kitchenette bazaar was much the same as I'd left it. But when I opened the canister where I expected to find peppermint, I found something else. With a mounting sense of dread, I recognized it as gum guaiacum, the very thing Judith once said could get rid of an unwanted child. I stood there, staring into the depths of that shadowy canister, trying to deny the truth of what I was seeing. Then a question came out of the dark. "What are you looking for, Patsy?" Nancy's sharp profile emerged from the shadows, startling me. And the sight of her in her night clothes, hair unkempt, as if she'd just tumbled from a man's bed, made my heart hard. Rounding on her, I whispered, "Who was it? Who was the father?" Nancy turned so that her face fell into the shadows. "I don't know what you're saying." I brought the candle closer, wanting to see the truth in her eyes. "Was it Theo? God rest his soul." It couldn't have been freakishly boyish John, whose impotence made it impossible. That left Theo as the least horrifying possibility. If spirited young Nancy had fallen in love with sickly Theo, if he'd meant to marry her but died before he could...
"There was no baby,"
Nancy hissed, still turned away. I wanted to believe her. Truly I did. But if she was telling the truth, why couldn't she meet my eyes? "Then it was Richard," I asked, appalled. Their union would be considered not merely adulterous, but also incestuous. Still, there was a worse possibility, one that might explain the determination of slaves to spread the gossip even under threat of their master's whip. I took another step closer, my own voice trembling.
"Or was it a Negro slave?"
Nancy's jaw snapped shut, and she finally dared to meet my eyes, hers burning like coals. I said there was no baby, Patsy. Do you hear me? There was no baby.
I didn't know if she was lying to me or lying to herself. I only knew she was lying. Every hair lifted on the nape of my neck at her desperation, hoping it was only the kind of desperation that would drive a terrified, unmarried girl to abort her baby, and not the kind that might allow her lover to chop up that baby once it was born.
"Oh, Nancy," I said, nearing tears for the dead child and the pain this would cause her family, and how it would destroy my husband. She grabbed my arm like a drowning woman.
"Say you hear me. There never was a baby."
There never was a baby. Just like my father had never wanted to kill himself, never taken a married woman as his lover, and never conceived a child with Sally Hemings.
"I hear you, Nancy," I said bitterly.
"I hear you."
Chapter 20. Philadelphia, 12 November, 1792. From Thomas Jefferson to Martha Jefferson Randolph.
"I have nothing to tell you but that I love you dearly, and your dear connections. That I am well, as is Maria. I hope your little one has felt no inconvenience from the journey, that Anne is quite recovered, and Mr. Randolph's health good. Yours is so firm that I am less apt to apprehend for you. Still, however, take care of your good health and of your affection to me, which is the solace of my life."
Wanting to protect my husband's good health, I said nothing to him about the gum guaiacum or my confrontation with his sister. It wouldn't have done him any good, and may have done a great deal of harm. If it became known that Nancy had been pregnant, the prospects of her entire life would be forever diminished. She'd find it nearly impossible to secure a husband. She'd become a spinster, forever a financial burden on the family, without any place to call her own. So I told myself to be kind to Nancy, that she'd been preyed upon by a man who ought to have known better, that she was a victim of error, if not slander, and it'd be best to carry her away from here. We'd take Nancy with us, maybe to Charlottesville, where we could marry her quickly before the rumor spread. But Nancy would have none of it.
"If I go, it'll only feed the gossip."
"Nonsense," I said, folding my own clothes for the trunk as my maid was nowhere to be found. "No one in Albemarle will have heard about this." I was determined to drag Nancy away if necessary, but Judith surprised me by making herself the most formidable obstacle to my plans. She went directly to my husband and said,
"If you take Nancy, it'll reflect poorly on Richard. It'll look as though you don't trust your own brother-in-law."
Knowing Richard had seduced Judith before their marriage, I guessed my husband wouldn't find this argument compelling. Tom snapped,
"How can it be unmannerly to take my own sister home with me?"
Then Richard's brother John intervened.
"Now, Tom," he drawled, smoothly stretching out his name, "if you take Nancy, it'll look as if you don't believe her innocence."
If there was anyone at Bazaar we were certain hadn't seduced Nancy, it was John. Stunted but more effusive than a Frenchman, he was as persuasive as a serpent in the Garden of Eden. So we left Nancy there. We were quiet on the way home, but for little Anne, whimpering at every bump in the road, unable to keep down her breakfast of milk-soaked biscuit. The journey should have only taken hours, but with our girl spitting up and our boy fussing at my breast, it seemed like days. I was already weary when we rolled up to the mountain top and saw Sally on the front portico, her amber eyes intent on me.
"Miss Patsy, she said with an urgency that told me she'd been waiting. Though every other slave on the plantation now called me Mistress Randolph, Sally rarely did, either a sign of her intimacy with me or our complicated history. Waiting until Tom had gone in the house with the babies, she rushed up to me. "There's a rumor in Charlottesville about your Randolph kin, about Miss Nancy." That the news had traveled so far, so fast, surprised me. But it shouldn't have. In slave society, families on one plantation almost always had kin on another. Slaves hired out. They traveled as messengers, worked as boatmen and coach drivers, and saw one another at church. If they wanted to get word to each other, they could. What should have surprised me was the insistence of the slaves telling this tale, even under threat of their master's whip. With a weary sigh, I nodded. "We've heard it, Sally. It's just Mr. Harrison's people telling a malicious story, and they'll be punished for spreading it." Sally gave a quick shake of her head, her bronze fingers tightening into fists. "At least 12 of Mr. Harrison's people claim to know something of it personally. Maid saw Miss Nancy naked and big with child. Some heard her scream at night. Some saw Richard Randolph go into her room. And there's a blood-stained wood shingle." So Richard had apparently taken no care to shield his sins from their eyes. Such indiscretion might be that of a man who wished to help his sister-in-law in need, or in a man who was guilty. Either way, it was the act of a fool. Sally leaned in. "White folk are talking, too. Mr. Page says he's seen Richard Randolph's familiarity with Miss Nancy, kissing and hugging on her. Nancy's aunt says she saw her in a state of undress, that she was with child. And the white housekeeper saw bloody sheets the next day." White witnesses. That changed absolutely everything. I glanced nervously at the house, hoping Tom was well out of earshot. Sally lowered her voice to a whisper. "I heard it at Mr. Bell's store. My sister Mary thought it might touch on us here at Monticello, given that Miss Nancy stayed here for a time, and given what people are saying about your father." That stopped me cold. "What are people saying about Papa?" Sally's pretty dark lashes swept low. "You haven't seen the Gazettes?" Most of the Hemingses could read and write, though how they'd learned, I'd never asked. Still, it surprised me a little that they'd been following matters in the papers. "Let me see them."
"We haven't any papers here," Sally said. "They're all down at Mr. Bell's store."
"But it's dreadful. In the press, Master Jefferson is being attacked for everything from intrigue to dishonor." Fury washed through me. I was already road-weary and worried for my husband's state, and now to learn Papa had been attacked. Despite my exhaustion, I got back in the carriage and summoned Sally to follow, telling the driver, "To Charlottesville, straight away." Mr. Bell's store stood on the corner of Main Street. Boxes and barrels crowded together in the middle of the wood plank floor, while tins and glass bottles and blue-painted plates lined the shelves. The scent of lavender wafted down from baskets hanging on the eaves overhead, so that, tall as I was, I had to stoop to get to the counter where Mary Hemmings busied herself boxing up a pipe for a customer who replied, "Thank you, Mrs. Bell." Mary wasn't Mr. Bell's wife, but given the way Thomas Bell smiled at her from where he stacked goods on a high shelf, he was plainly smitten. Everyone in Charlottesville seemed willing to accept the arrangement, and I was happy to do the same. Sally sorted through stacks of pamphlets and pulled free some copies of the Gazette of the United States. Handing them to me, she warned, "It'll sicken you." Nevertheless, I began flipping through the pages of papers published this past summer and fall. My eyes landed on one passage right away. cautious and shy, wrapped up in impenetrable silence and mystery, seated on his pivot chair, Mr. Jefferson is involved in political deception. I'd seldom heard a word of censure against my father. He'd been, here in America and in France, idolized by nearly everyone. I suppose that's why my cheeks stung to read such pointed criticism. Rifling through pages so violently I might have torn them, I found another attack.
Had an inquisitive mind sought evidence of Mr. Jefferson's abilities as a statesman, he'd have found the confusions in France. As a warrior, to his exploits at Monticello. As a mathematician, to his whirligig chair.
I frowned anew that anyone might blame the confusions in France upon Papa, and not the royalists who bankrupted their country and left the peasants to starve. It embittered me, too, that we were to still suffer censure for our late-night flight from Monticello, where I supposed they believed we ought to have brandished pistols and pitchforks against the trained British dragoons, women and children and all. And what was their obsession with my father's chair?
As a philosopher, his discovery of the inferiority of blacks to whites, because they're unsavory and secrete more by the kidneys.
There, I stopped. Remembering that Sally had brought this to my attention. Perhaps if I'd not come of age in France, I wouldn't have felt such an acute shame. But I couldn't look at either Sally or Mary. I could only whisper, "Who wrote this? Do we know these men?" Mr. Bell stepped down off his ladder.
"Some say it's the Secretary of the Treasury using different names."
Given all my father had said of Mr. Hamilton, I believed it.
But plenty of others agree with him. Not just Northerners, either. John Marshall is leading the Federalists here in Virginia, and now Patrick Henry is going over to that side, too.
Patrick Henry. The very man who cried, "Give me liberty or give me death," had spread the story of my father's supposed cowardice in the face of British soldiers. Though I had only childhood memories of the famous orator, I'd long disliked Patrick Henry as my father's political enemy. Now my anger was fueled anew. "They're calling on your father to resign," Sally said, pulling me from my bitter thoughts. "They're digging for an excuse, and a gossip about your kin. Nancy Randolph hasn't been under my father's roof in nearly 2 years." Quickly, I brought my fingers to my lips, as if to recall what I'd said, for it was a tacit admission that I believed my sister-in-law guilty. Fortunately, if the Hemingses knew anything, it was discretion. Clutching one of the screeds against my father, Sally replied, "It doesn't seem as if Federalist writers care much for facts or fairness." No, they didn't. And if these men could work themselves up into such a furor over my father's chair, what would they make of kin who lived in incestuous and adulterous union and murdered a baby? Still, I tried to persuade myself that the scandal wouldn't touch my family. Surely no one could think my father would tolerate the debauching. There, I trailed off. I couldn't pretend in front of the Hemingses, no matter how discreet they might be, that nothing improper ever took place under my father's roof. For Sally Hemings was proof that, in fact, it did. Honor. In Virginia, it wasn't merely a matter of masculine pride, it was a matter of survival. Every loan for the farm, every advance of credit for seeds and foodstuffs, every public office and proposal of marriage depended on honor. Men would fight and die for it, and women would lie for it. Which is why, whenever asked about the rumors about Nancy and Richard, as I was more and more often that spring, I dismissed it as an absurd story having no merit. If only others had done the same. When Tom learned there were white witnesses, he flew into a rage that had him slamming about the house, heaping undeserved abuse on every servant he passed. And whenever he heard Richard's name, he cursed in the most obscene manner possible. Egged on by his younger brother, Tom determined to ride out and rescue Nancy from the clutches of her seducer, who must be made to confess and suffer the loss of his honor. Tom said it often, and to everyone who'd listen, which struck me as madness, for it fueled the gossip. But then the entire world had gone mad. The new revolutionary government in France had charged Lafayette with treason. A galling notion, the very idea of Lafayette being a traitor to the revolution he helped start was an unjust, enraging indignity. More ridiculous and horrifying was that in attempting to escape arrest, Lafayette had been caught by counter-revolutionary forces, who also deemed him a traitor. He was, as of the last news we had, in a dungeon awaiting execution. Even consumed at Monticello with chores, child-rearing, and family scandal, I couldn't seem to shake the violence this news did to my faith in the revolution. What knaves had come to power in France that they could turn on Lafayette? Perhaps the same sort of knaves who hounded my father in the papers, savaging his ethics and twisting every word that flowed from his pen. That's why I wasn't surprised when Papa wrote to tell me that he couldn't resign for fear his enemies would say he was driven out of office, or that Washington had no confidence in him. Or they'd say that he ran from public office like he ran from the British. No, he couldn't be seen to leave under a cloud. I was brooding about this while making bayberry wax candles, Tom's favorite, because of its pleasant fragrance. It soothed him, he said, and he clearly needed soothing, given the way his boots banged heavily into the cellar kitchen where I prepared the wicks. Arms crossed over his chest, as if he could scarcely contain his pounding heart, Tom growled out,
"Richard dared to show his face at Tuckahoe with a shameless cur."
Shameless indeed for the seducer to have visited the home of his victim's father and brothers, I thought. Reckless, even. It wouldn't have surprised me to hear Colonel Randolph had pulled a pistol on him. What did he have to say for himself? Tom threw out his arms.
"Richard asked, nay, demanded, that we stop accusing him of despoiling our sister's purity."
Let it never be said that the Randolphs, any of them, lacked in boldness. While I let out a surprised puff of air, Tom ranted on.
"Richard first insisted it was all a malicious lie. He claimed Nancy's virtue is still intact, and that if we wanted to preserve her reputation, we ought to all keep quiet and join a slander suit against anyone who'd spread the tale."
"Perhaps that's best," I ventured. "If the family doesn't rally around your sister and profess a belief in her innocence, Nancy will be ruined."
"She is ruined,"
Tom exploded, his voice echoing off the ceiling.
"When my father refused, Richard tried his next gambit. He has a letter written by Nancy confessing her pregnancy and naming a dead man as her seducer. Her letter allegedly says Theo was the father, the child was stillborn, and she absolves Richard of all culpability."
I gasped that Nancy should put such a confession to paper, then flushed to remember that I'd suggested Theo as her seducer in the first place. Poor, deluded Nancy must have determined that if she couldn't save herself, she'd save her lover instead. "You have the letter." Tom's hand flexed at his side, then balled in a tight fist.
"Richard kept it and intends to vindicate himself on a field of honor. He's called out my brother."
Icy dread rushed through my veins. "Your brother will duel over this.
No, my brother won't give Richard the satisfaction of pretending he's an equal or a man of honor. But I swear, if Richard Randolph tries to transfer the stigma and evade blame, I will wash out the stain on my family honor with his blood.
Now the icy dread froze inside me, for I'd never heard such a sure promise of violence in my life, and it came from the man that I'd married, the man I'd come to love. Trying to reason with him, I murmured, "But Theo is dead. He's the one least likely to suffer for it. Maybe you should let him take the blame for the blot on your sister's reputation."
Tom slammed his hand to the tabletop. "Richard did it, Patsy. He did everything they're saying he did. That creature seduced my sister, both my sisters. Then he killed an innocent babe. It isn't gossip. I know it happened. I know it's all true."
Alarmed at the state he was working himself into, I put my hand on his cheek. "Tom, if it's going to destroy your family, what does it matter if it's true?" At this question, my husband jerked away, his black eyes burning.
"What sort of man do you take me for, Martha Jefferson Randolph?"
He so seldom used my proper name that I stiffened. So did he.
"If he pushes me to it, I'll put a bullet in his heart, because I'm a gentleman of Virginia and cannot countenance a lie."
To this day, I don't know why his words provoked me so. Perhaps it was that, like my mother before me, I'd heard my fill of supposedly high-minded ideals that rocked nations, put unhappy women in their graves, and somehow ended with people I loved being chased or captured to await execution. Which would be exactly the fate of Richard and Nancy if their own kin wouldn't come to their aid. Or it could end with a duel and my husband, the father of my babies, shot dead. I wouldn't have it. I simply wouldn't have it. "What sort of man do I take you for, Thomas Mann Randolph? Why, I suppose the sort of man who has enough sense to keep his mouth shut even if it costs him some pride." In reply, Tom screamed in my face, "You dare speak to me about the cost of pride? We were there at Bazaar when my sister's bastard was conceived, there where I took Nancy on your say-so. If Richard Randolph isn't to blame for my sister's disgrace, then I am. And everyone in Virginia seems to know it but you." I never saw the blow coming. My husband's backhand caught me high on the cheek, and pain exploded behind my eye in a burst of tiny fireworks. I don't remember falling, and for a second or two, I couldn't fathom how I came to be on the floor. My vision swam with tears and black fuzzy cobwebs of pain. No one had ever put violent hands on me. Never in my whole life. Not even a nun had so much as laid a strap across my knuckles. I think it was the shock of it more than the pain that left me trembling so badly I couldn't rise to my knees. When I finally looked up, I saw that my husband looked just as shocked.
"Dear God,"
Tom whispered hoarsely, sinking to the floor beside me. He brought his shaking hand to my hair, and I flinched, refusing to let him tilt my face to his view.
"Dear God, what have I done to you?"
I'm not sure what I'd have said had the door not flown open. But open it did, and there stood Sally, her kerchief tied on her head, her brow furrowing as she took in the scene.
"What do you think you're doing, Sally?"
Tom snapped.
"No one called for you."
She ought to have fled, but when her majestic eyes found me sprawled on the floor, she jutted her lower lip stubbornly. "Thought I heard something fall. You all right, Miss Patsy?" I couldn't bear for Sally to know how I'd been disciplined by my husband, that he'd struck me just as I'd once struck her. perfectly fine, I said over the lump in my throat. These long and clumsy legs of mine get tangled up sometimes. Tripped over that basket. If she knew I was lying, she gave nothing away. Pushing past my husband, she said, I'll help you up. But gently taking my forearms, Tom said,
No need. I have her now.
I was almost glad that he'd hit me. Glad because it absolved me of my guilt. I'd fretted about my father's reputation, but I'd given too little thought to Tom's. I deserved to be slapped to my senses. Everyone would have thought so. Besides, the incident seemed to have shaken Tom to his foundations. The man who said his honor wouldn't countenance a lie hadn't contradicted the story I told Sally. He'd taken me to our bedroom and suffered no one else to tend me, bringing me a cold wet cloth for my face and my supper tray with a bouquet of springtime flowers from the gardens. Now he sat at my bedside, kissing my hand again and again, wetting it with his tears.
Forgive me, Patsy, though I don't deserve it. Please forgive me for lifting a hand against you. What a wretched man I am. Heartless, just like my father.
You aren't wretched or heartless, I said softly, reminding myself that I'd no right to speak to him the way I did, and that he had every right to correct me for it. I'll gladly forgive your lifting a hand against me, if you forgive me for having given such offense to have occasioned it. His voice was still shaky, his thumb reaching to brush the rising bruise underneath my eye.
There's nothing you could say to justify my leaving such a mark on you. I've hurt you, my adored wife.
Though my cheek still throbbed, I said, It'll heal and be forgotten. His expression crumbled again, with anguish and self-loathing.
No, I'll never forget it, and it'll never happen again. I'll never again betray the sacred charge your father put in me in giving you over into my authority. A husband ought to be kind and indulgent with his wife, to protect her from harm. It won't happen again, Patsy.
I believed him. His tortured expression would have been enough to convince me, but his behavior after confirmed it. For Tom never again spoke of dueling with Richard Randolph, and resolved to be the peacemaker in his family. He didn't even rise to the bait when Richard published a screed in the General Advertiser, proclaiming his innocence and condemning his accusers without naming them. Everyone in Virginia knew he was slinging mud at my husband, but Tom kept his peace, determined not to give himself over to rage again. And I loved him more for it. Watching him struggle against undeserved abuse from such a villain made me forgive him truly. But then I was prone to forgiveness in the aftermath of Richard Randolph's wretched newspaper notice, especially since the very same issue announced the execution of the King of France. In truth, this news was more of a blow than the one my husband had dealt me. I never thought the French would put King Louis to the guillotine. The revolutionary men in my father's parlor in Paris never even suggested it. Perhaps with France at war with its neighbors, the revolutionaries feared to hold the king captive when his very life encouraged enemies to attack them. And King Louis was guilty of all the crimes they accused him of. But even believing that, the account in the paper made my fingers rise up to my own throat as I fought back the horror of imagining the blades slicing through it. Who were these Jacobins who had condemned Lafayette a traitor and killed the king? Until this news, Papa and I had held in contempt those who complained of the revolution's excesses. They hadn't witnessed all we'd witnessed in France, But the men who had seized the reins there now, could they be the same men that Papa and I had known and admired? Surely not. Papa could explain it, I was sure. And I was near desperate to have him home, especially when he wrote that the news of Richard and Nancy's disgrace had reached him all the way in Philadelphia. The damned story would not die. The slaves wouldn't let it. And every white man in Virginia who ever resented the haughty Randolphs called for justice. By the time April wildflowers were in bloom at Monticello, Richard sat in a Cumberland County jail, accused of fathering a child on his wife's sister and murdering the babe. And I was called to testify. Chapter 21 The Cumberland courthouse was packed, cheek to jowl, between old wooden walls. "Jefferson's daughter," someone said as I entered, and the courtroom erupted, every gawker and gossip monger in the county craning their necks to get a better look. "Mrs. Randolph," someone else cried. But beneath the white satin bow and broad rim of my fashionable hat, I kept my eyes on the magistrates. 16 men in powdered wigs in whose hands the fate of my family's reputation now resided. I made my way through the crowd with the gliding gait I had learned at the court of Versailles, my skirts swishing, white lace upon blue ruffled petticoat, while whispers flew from one row of wooden benches to the next. "Is her gown from Paris? She's wearing a revolutionary cockade. What will she say?" I knew the lawyers for the defense. The fire-breathing Patrick Henry and the grim-faced John Marshall. Federalists. Both men nodded to me respectfully, as if they thought I didn't know them to be my father's enemies. As if those glory-seeking creatures thought to convince me, for even one moment, that they wouldn't use whatever happened in the trial to tarnish my father in the papers if they could. I smiled serenely as I was called to stand beneath the drape of red, white, and blue, the colors of both beloved flags I'd seen waved to champion the cause of freedom. Pushing artfully coiffed copper ringlets of hair from my face, I looked out into a crowd of old Virginia gentry in fine coats and breeches, frontier planters wearing hunting shirts and homespun, and housewives in mop caps and bonnets. Some were friendly, others were eager to see the Randolphs fall. Offered a leather-bound Bible on which to swear, I was informed that the charge was murder, a fact I knew all too well. Murder of an infant, punishable by death. As my hand hovered above the Bible, I glanced at the accused, my sister-in-law and her vile seducer. Richard looked smug, but Nancy trembled. Beneath my gloved hand, I felt the warmth of the leather. If ever there was a time to repair my breach with God, I thought, it was now. So I swore my sacred and solemn oath to tell the truth. Then I thought of the promise I had made to my mother to care for my father always. I thought of the sacrifices I'd made toward that end. A stain on Tom would be a stain on my father's name, too. A stain on all of us. "It was gum guaiacum," I said when put to question, my hand still upon the leather Bible. "That's what Nancy Randolph had been taking in her tea." At the table for the defense, John Marshall didn't look up. He merely continued to scribble notes of the proceedings. His co-counsel, Patrick Henry, however, threw me a look that blazed with surprise. Coming closer, Mr. Henry asked, "How could you possibly know this, Miss Jefferson?" "Mrs. Randolph," I corrected. "I'm a married woman now." He hadn't called me to testify at this hearing, after all, because he suspected I knew anything material. I hadn't been anywhere near the Harrison place when the wicked deed was allegedly done. I'd already told him this before the hearing, but he'd insisted on calling me anyway.
These two Federalist lawyers had called me to perform at this spectacle for one reason, and one reason only.
To embarrass my father. To connect the Jefferson name to this scandal by whatever means necessary, even while arguing on behalf of my Randolph kin. They thought they were so clever. They thought they knew my father's weak spots. Maybe they did. But they didn't know me or mine. You're asking how I know Nancy Randolph took gum guaiacum? I let my eyes slide past the old firebrand to settle upon my pale and trembling sister-in-law and the devil that brought us all to this state. Not Richard, though he too was a villain, but Colonel Randolph, whose indifference to his children had sent them fleeing his house. There the old buzzard stood, gouty and in ill health, doing nothing whatsoever to save his own daughter's life. And standing next to him was Gabriella Harvey, with a sweet smile on her face, as if she weren't half to blame for driving her stepdaughter to such peril. Richard stood accused, but Nancy's life was at stake, too. Popular sentiment ran so strongly against them that the prisoner had to be taken to the jail under heavy guard. If this hearing went badly, he'd face the gallows, because murder was a capital offense. Adultery, fornication, incest, and bastardy were crimes, too, but I doubted anyone could remember the last time someone was prosecuted for those, even here in Virginia. No, it was the death of the baby that had put Richard in his grave, and Nancy thereafter, for she'd be charged with infanticide, the only crime for which women were legally presumed guilty rather than innocent. Knowing this, I steeled myself. I made sure not to look at my tall, beautiful, but temperamental husband. And though each false word bit at the edge of my tongue with the sharp conviction of the guillotine, I let the blade fly. The reason I know Nancy Randolph took gum guaiacum is because I gave it to her. A collective intake of breath punctuated a chorus of shocked murmurs that echoed from one side of the courtroom to the other. All 16 magistrates leaned in closer to hear my words, the curls of their powdered wigs bobbing as they stared. Even the unflappable John Marshall looked up from his scroll, one eye twitching. Patrick Henry's jowls reddened.
Do you mean to say, Miss Jefferson?
Mrs. Randolph. The fire breather advanced.
Are you telling this court that you provided an aborter fashion to your sister-in-law?
Without lowering my gaze, I nodded. Yes, I did. The prosecutor was suddenly on his feet.
Do you know what you're saying, woman? It is your testimony that you knowingly aided and abetted Nancy Randolph in ridding herself of a bastard child by giving her a dangerous medicine to produce an abortion?
Inside, I was all a tremble, but I somehow kept my voice steady and calm. You're a Jefferson, I thought, as if to spite Colonel Randolph. Sunny disposition, but ice water in your veins. No, sir. I'm not confessing to a crime. In truth, I hadn't the slightest notion that Nancy could have been with child, though obviously I suspect it now. At my words, Patrick Henry couldn't recover swiftly enough. It was John Marshall whose cool question cut through the crowded courtroom.
If you had no notion that Nancy Randolph might be with child, why did you supply her with the gum?
That was the question I'd needed someone to ask. And I wanted to pat Mr. Marshall on the head like a good dog for asking it. I gave her the gum because I know it is an excellent medicine for colic. So when my sister-in-law complained of colic, you know Nancy has been afflicted with colic as long as I've known her. The judges looked impatient with my aside, but I saw hatted heads nod amongst the spectators. I'd laid my ground over 100 teacups these past weeks, sighing of Nancy's delicate stomach. Was there a soul in Virginia who wouldn't swear she'd always had colic? Not after the seeds I'd sown. "She's delicate that way," I said. "It runs in the family. So when I visited a few weeks before the incident, I added some of the resin to her tea and encouraged her to avail herself of it whenever she felt her pains coming on." Nancy went even paler at my story, shock and confusion warring in her expression. Meanwhile, Mr. Marshall was quick to seize upon my testimony.
"Did the defendant, Richard Randolph, know that you provided such medicine to the women in his household?"
I gave a disdainful sniff. Womanly troubles are hardly the sort of thing a gentlewoman of Virginia discusses with menfolk. Unless, of course, she's dragged from hearth and home to talk about it before the whole county. I heard a chuckle in the audience, followed by another. I'd been a little tart, but not too tart. They were charmed by me, I hoped. Marshall leaned forward.
"Is that why you didn't mention it before now?"
Acutely aware that my husband was in this courtroom, no doubt burning a hole in me with his dark eyes, I replied, "I hadn't thought of it before now. I came here believing the accusation was against Richard for some criminal mischief. But when I heard witnesses blaming Nancy for taking an elixir, that's when I remembered the gum." I don't think I fooled the owlish Mr. Marshall, but he wasn't about to lose a case by contradicting me. I'd given him the bait. Now it was up to the illustrious lawyers for the defense. I'd provided all the evidence they should need to persuade the magistrates that even if Nancy had been delivered of a child, it was likely stillborn, its death an accident, not murder. But would anyone believe me?
"Not guilty," came the verdict.
Richard let out a triumphant cry while Nancy's knees nearly buckled underneath her. Some people cried, "Shame, shame," not at Richard, but at his accusers, many of whom were slaves, forbidden from testifying at all. Given the glee with which Richard celebrated the verdict, hooting with no sense of decorum, he seemed to believe himself vindicated, his honor restored. I knew better. In the end, he'd been saved by women. By Nancy's willingness to sacrifice her own honor by writing that letter, by my willingness to lie, and even by his poor, betrayed wife. Judy had stayed by his side, insisting to the court that her husband and her sister were innocent. What other option did she have? She couldn't let him die. Neither could she leave him and go back to her father, even if Colonel Randolph would have had her back. She was Richard Randolph's wife, and could never be separated from him. His fate was her fate. If he was ruined, so was she. So if she had to pretend her husband had no carnal knowledge of her sister, then that's what she'd do. I felt so sorry for Judy, betrayed once already by her husband and her own sister. Sorrier still, when Richard insisted that Nancy return with them to Bazaar. For a moment I feared that my husband would rush upon Nancy and tear her away from her lover, or, much worse, that he'd descend upon Richard and dash his head open on the cobblestones. But in spite of all the rage brewing in him, my husband kept his silence, a thing more galling to him than perhaps any other indignity of his life. And I was so unutterably proud of him, though I remained more than a little frightened of his reaction to what I'd done. Nancy never thanked me for it, never spared me a glance.
I supposed it was because she knew perfectly well the judgment she'd see in my eyes, for she'd already seen it that night in the darkness of Bazaar's kitchen. For my husband's sake, I'd saved her life. But I knew they were guilty. I knew not only that they were guilty, but also that only a small part of the world would be influenced by the decision of the court. Nevertheless, we watched Tom's disgraced sister climb into Richard's phaeton and drive off with him, either too stupid or too deluded to realize that she ought to be chastened to her soul by the entire sordid debacle. In our carriage back home, Tom quietly said, "They'd have strung my sister up." "Yes," I replied, nervously wetting my lips. His gaze burned into the side of my face. "They would have strung her up, if not for you." "Yes," I said again, swallowing hard. This dark man of savage impulses stared so hard I felt on the precipice of something awful. But then his voice lowered to a whisper.
"I suppose, then, it's good you remembered the gum."
I turned to him but wasn't able to meet his eyes. "I wish I'd remembered it sooner." He tilted his dark head of hair against the cushion as we rattled down the road. He was tired, wrung out from the whole ordeal. But just when I thought he'd fallen asleep, he said,
"I pray I never hear another word about it."
At summer's end, Papa burst in the front door of Monticello, my little sister all but yipping at his heels with the dogs she'd left behind. After patting their ears and kissing their heads, Polly ran to me, threw her arms around my waist, and hugged me so tight I could scarcely breathe. I couldn't get enough of looking at her. During her time with Papa in Philadelphia, she'd somehow transformed into a beautiful girl of 15, with a heart-shaped face, bones like a bird, and a tiny waist that would be the envy of every woman in Virginia. My father shook Tom's hand, and Tom managed to smile. He'd been dreadfully ill that summer, as though the family scandal had sickened him to the core. But at his smile, my father's return, and Polly's embrace, I felt whole again. Everything was right. Safe in the warm glow of my father's love, I hadn't the faintest urge to tell him anything more than must be told about the recent unpleasantness. Meanwhile, Sally, who hung back in the hall, twisted her hands anxiously, as if it took a real effort not to run to Papa, too. Papa noticed her, I was sure, but turned away as he settled into his favorite chair in the parlor and said,
"I have news."
President Washington had personally asked him not to resign as Secretary of State, but he felt that his term would soon come to an end. First, however, he hoped to negotiate for the release of Lafayette from prison. Polly piped up with, "Hopefully Mr. Short can help. He's been appointed minister to the Netherlands, but he's had contact with Lafayette." The sudden pain William's name caused caught me entirely unawares. I'd forbidden myself to think of him. I was a wife and mother, and I loved my little family. I loved Tom. But I'd never told my husband about William. And the unexpected mention of him now, with Tom sitting close beside me, holding my hand, made me acutely aware of the lie of omission. I nearly burned with it. But my curiosity pricked at me even more sharply. Affecting nonchalance, I asked, "I thought Mr. Short was to be the Minister of France."
"That post went to Governor Morris," my father replied. "Some say it's for the best. Mr. Short has, after all, become disenchanted with Paris since the King and the Duke de La Rochefoucauld were executed."
The Duke, much like Lafayette, had helped give birth to France's constitution.
Why was the revolution now eating its fathers? I wondered if such a thing could happen here. Polly said, "After the Duke was executed, Mr. Short was quite frantic for